Yesterday, we discussed a little bit about communication using electromagnetic fields, well, massless fields in general, and we made a series of claims that seemed reasonable. For example, that information is transmitted by energy carrying quanta, as in like exchange of energy. An emitter emits photons, a receiver captures photons. That's the way we tend to think about communication. Even really, really good people have written in books that to establish communication, you need to exchange light, to exchange photons, right? Information flows also are therefore carried by average energy flows, right? If the information will reach you when energy reaches you. And of course, it's only possible at the speed of light, but not slower than the speed of light. Okay, and then that means that if I beam an empty chair and I wait 20 minutes, then the laser beam is already gone, or the flashlight beam is already gone, and then someone comes 20 minutes after, they're gonna sit there and they're not gonna get any message because it's long gone. There's no echo left in the massless field, no? And I claimed that in general, these assumptions are all wrong, not correct. All right. Any questions so far? Maybe you can already believe this, right? Because you saw a result yesterday on the signaling of detector A to detector B, right? The influence of detector state of detector A on detector B after interacting with the field. And we saw that that depended on some integral over the Pauli-Jordan with and also the smearing of the detectors, right? And that in particular tells you that in principle you can communicate, you can signal wherever the commutator is supported, the expectation of the commutator is supported. And in the tutorial yesterday, you computed the commutator in flat space-time in three different cases, right? With different dimensions. And then you saw that in the time-like area, well, in 3+1 dimensions, there's no commutator, agreed? It's not supported inside of the light cone. However, in 1+1 dimensions is very supported, in fact it's constant, right? And in 2+1 dimensions there's a polynomial decay within the light cone, right? All right. So, oh yeah, that's kind of nice. Here they did it well. Like, I'm happy with the way they did the popular science things. I have it here sometimes because they really did. To be honest, the way they did it right is they email the authors. They email us and we could reply and say thanks, which is nice, right? And they actually pay attention to that, which is nice to do popular science. They claim like photon afterglow could transmit information without transmitting energy. That's nice. And the thing, I don't like the use of virtual photons, but fine, they really wanted to use virtual photons. So they say instead of using real photons, which always carry energy, the technique uses a small, newly predicted quantum afterglow. Well, this is quantum or not, we'll discuss it, of virtual photons that do not need to carry energy. And it's nice, although no energy is transmitted, the receiver must provide the energy needed to detect the incoming signal. It's kind of nice, they did a good job. They get kind of keywords from the paper, they also consulted if they were well written. I personally oppose to the use of virtual photons, but then again, that's me. And we may discuss why if you want the word virtual photons. Truth be told, co-authors on these works, some of them are okay with the virtual photon picture. I'm not, but that's just me. We'll talk about it if you want. So let's analyze why this happens, right? And how quantum this really is, if any, and so on. So this goes all the way back to some subtleties, if you want, in the behavior of the solutions of some partial differential equations, as for example, the wave equation, which is behind propagation of signals in massless fields. So Strong-Huygens principle, what is that? So let me state it for you. Strong-Huygens principle says the Green's function of the, we're talking radiation Green function, of the massless wave equation in 3+1D Minkowski space has support only on the light cone. Hence, any disturbances propagate strictly along null geodesics, speed of light. That's the Strong-Huygens principle. Everyone happy with that? There's a statement, there's a theorem, you can prove it. Okay? You kind of did, actually, because you computed the radiation Green function yesterday, which is the Pauli-Jordan, the expectation of the commutator. So So when what can wonder, so this is true, which means that in 3 plus 1 dimensions, all those statements, flat space-time, 3 plus 1 dimensions, all those statements that I made about wireless communication carry. Okay. Let's see, but you can wonder, like, how general is this? Exploitable diameters are quantum. Oh, the reason I write this, because if you have a two-level system, right, interacting with the field, you need to have coherences in the two-level system, if you remember. It doesn't work with a rho that is diagonal in the energy eigenbasis. So for a two-level system, for two antennas that are two-level systems, you do require something quantum, I guess, in the sense that you need superpositions of energy eigenstates. And again, we can discuss, is that quantum, is it not? That's what I meant by that, okay? For two-level systems, for other kind of detectors, you may not need that even. Anyway, a little bit of, if you want to get a little bit more into this, some of the technical details are in these papers here. If you're interested, they will get this, right, in the course PDF or whatever. So we saw, okay, fine. This is true in 3 plus 1. The Strong-Huygens principle applies in 3 plus 1 flat spacetime. How general is that? Well, the answer is that in general, it's not. Strong-Huygens principle fails almost everywhere. Strong-Huygens, in fact, as I said, mathematicians that work on that, we had very illustrious mathematicians here in Waterloo working on this problem, Ray McLanagan being one of them, for example, now retired in the Applied Math Department in the University of Waterloo. And what they actually look for is like, well, we want spacetimes in which Strong-Huygens is satisfied. They don't care about the cases where it's violated, which is interesting because for physicists, that's the least intuitive one, I guess. But if you actually are into these things, you realize actually it's very rare. 3 plus 1 flat, or if you want odd plus 1 flat, which happens for odd plus 1, you have the Strong-Huygens principle. You don't have it for even special dimensions. You don't have it for 1 plus 1 either. All the other dimensions, even larger than 1 plus 1, sorry, odd larger than 1 plus 1, or special dimension larger than 1 plus 1, would have Strong-Huygens principle. But the moment you have curvature, it becomes difficult, like extremely difficult, to find spacetimes where Strong-Huygens is satisfied, having support only on null separation. Okay? So mathematicians actually look for cases where that happens, which are difficult to find. So basically, what this tells me is in curved spacetime, communication through massless fields is not confined to the light cone, if you want, but there'll be a leakage of information towards the inside of the light cone, decoupled from energy propagation. And then you can wonder, oh, but that's kind of trivial, right? It's because light cones are not like 45-degree lines in curved spacetime. No, I'm talking null separation. You can have signaling to time-like. That's what I'm talking about. Okay, it's not that some of the null geodesics don't form 45 degrees or anything like that. Huh? No, it's truly time-like communication, what you can do with this. So the support of the commutator is time-like. All right. Let's look at this from the perspective of a particular example. Let's do a little bit, because we haven't done general relativity in this course. Sadly, this course is too short, I think. But let's see what we can do in one simple curved spacetime that is of interest. Let's consider. I say curve and I say flat here, but flat, you know what I mean by that, right? Flat spatial sections, that's what I took here. Okay, of course, spacetime is curved. I get okay, FL RW spacetime, I didn't write the L this time, in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And of course, let's assume that this geometry will be generated by a perfect fluid with this equation of state, okay? So the scale factor, of course, evolves like this. So that's the kind of power law expansion that you have. By the way, we can also do it in the sitter, and I'll talk a little bit about the sitter. I'm going to do it for a matter-dominated universe. Well, I'm going to do it in general, and then at some point I will particularize to a matter-dominated universe, and then I will talk a little bit about what happens in the sitter as well. Okay. Right, so we have, of course, a quantum field living there. So, let's prepare this scalar field in the Banach-Davis vacuum, which is one of the vacua, if you want, that makes sense. That's related to the adiabatic vacuum. That's a state that is often assumed, a state that makes sense for the ground state of a scalar field in FRW or FLRW. And if you want, we discussed a little bit why choosing this state for the field. We can discuss more if that's reasonable. But I can tell you already, we just need a state of the field. It could be whatever you want, because our results are state independent. And by that, I mean we need a quantization scheme. We need to be able to quantize the field. Quantizing the field, like setting up canonical quantization processes, is akin to identifying a vacuum. Every quantization scheme has a vacuum. So that's why we have to say which vacuum we consider, which is actually another phrasing for what quantization scheme we use. But we do not depend on the state of the field. So once you can quantize, we just need this to quantize the field. When it's quantized, the field could be in any state. Okay, at the order of perturbation theory we're going to stay, that is going to be the same for any state. So far, so good? All right. Technicalities, but important ones, though. Of course, we use the Andrew Dewey detector, okay, that we've talked about. The Hamiltonian is very similar, only there's an issue in here. This is the scale factor. If you want, this is the element of volume, of course, particularized to a case in which the terminal of the metric is 1, but then doesn't really matter as much. You already know the model really well. Let's see. What are we going to use to identify signaling in this case, right? Because I proved to you that detector B fields detector A, right? That is fine if you're into field theory, right? But if you're also into quantum information, you may want to talk about bits per second and things like that, no? You want to know, okay, fine, give me a protocol. Can you give me the channel capacity? How many of you know what a channel, have you seen that notion of channel capacity? People? How many people know that or about that? Only one, okay. Channel capacity basically tells you the bits per use of the channel. You have a quantum channel, well, you have a channel, forget quantum. You have a channel, channels is a map. Channels are a map from some initial state to some final state that you can access. Huh? Some initial state of the receiver to some final state of the, sorry. Some initial state of the sender to some final state of the receiver, if you want. And the number of bits per second or bits per use of the channel that you can get is what we call the channel capacity. This is when you are connected to Wi-Fi, when they tell you several things, right? Well, the channel capacity would be equivalent to the bits per second using that channel. There are other things that we can talk about, like signal-to-noise ratio, which is what they give, usually in dBs, because dBs is kind of a cool unit in engineering. dBs, to me, makes sense when you are referring to some reference state. I have no idea what a reference state is for Wi-Fi. I never figured it out. And I ask engineers that work on this, and they tell me, oh, yeah, well, it's what we use. You know dB is what they are, right? They give you the order of magnitude in base 10 with some prefactor, because why not? And it's referred to some scale. So if you want, the scale is the one in which is 0 dBs, right? And then you say, OK, how many orders of magnitude above that? How many orders of magnitude below that? Well, I don't know. Maybe you know, you can tell me. I'll be really happy to listen why that is a meaningful kind of way of measuring things. Experimentalists in physics also like that. In quantum optics, people talk about squeeze states, by the way that we talked about, in dBs, which is basically how many orders of magnitude, if you want, can compress one quadrature compared to another one, kind of thing. Well, you need to learn it because that's what people use. But I don't understand why it's useful, though. Maybe for experiments it's useful somehow. Aggie, do you know why dBs are so used? Right, but you can use like 10 to the something, yeah? Yeah, I don't know.
I've heard in audio that 0 dB is...
Can't hear you.
I've heard for audio that 0 dB is...
Yeah, is that makes sense. Yeah. If you're measuring human response, that makes sense, because human response is logarithmic in general, like to touch, to sound, to light. So it makes sense. If you refer like the peak of human response at 0 dBs, that is great, right? As in like it's comfortable and understandable. That's like what I call the peak for humans. Then 0 dBs. That makes total sense to me. Then again, I don't know for the rest of the world why we use it for a Wi-Fi, for a phone, and so on. Anyway, so first we quantify the presence of A and B. So channel capacity actually requires you to maximize over all possible protocols of communication to really talk about channel capacity. But with phones and so on, we restrict the channel capacity to the protocol we're going to use. We're going to pick one protocol, and then we compute the channel capacity for that protocol. That means that that of course this is a lower bound on the channel capacity because maybe there's a better protocol. Okay? But it's definitely a protocol that gives you some idea how much information you can send. Now, I'm gonna show you two things. So we're gonna talk about two things. An estimation of the influence of the presence of A on B, which is, as you can tell, this is the probability of finding E excited. The receiver detector excited. We have two detectors, as we talked, and there's the probability of finding excited. This alpha B squared is the initial probability for the initial state of the detector. It's in a superposition of excited and ground, right? So this alpha B squared, is the notation we used yesterday, is the probability of finding it excited already, the local probability of finding it excited. Then, of course, you have the noise term, if you want, a local, the probability of finding it excited that does not depend on lambda A, if you remember. So that's the parts of the probability of finding it excited that you got were proportional if through dynamics, but it's through interactions with the state of the field. Okay, I call it vacuum there, but again, the state of the field, that is state dependent. That's why I call it vacuum, but it could be P and it's state dependent. Forget about vacuum. Okay, and then you have the signaling. The signaling term is the corrections to the probability that depend on lambda A, on the presence of lambda A. Okay. So that bit, the part of the probability of excitation that depends on lambda A, definitely is an estimation of signaling. When that is non-zero, then A can influence B. Agreed, people? Right. So, and we're gonna set ourselves, we're gonna compute in two cases. We're gonna talk about the Big Bang setting and then a setting that's predicted from the, some results in Luke quantum cosmology, which are related with bouncy universe, if you want. Okay. So let's begin with the Big Bang case in the standard cosmological model, which is general relativity, and we're gonna think about how much information from the early universe can make it to the late universe through these violations of Strong-Huygens. That's an interesting problem in itself. How do we observe the early universe? We observe it by using light, right? That's the way we do it. We either have radio telescopes, we either have optical telescopes, right? And that's it. We looked at things that happen in the early universe through light that arrives to us right now. We have other means, but we don't use them yet, like neutrinos. Not quite. Gravitational waves, we're working on it. Not with LIGO. LIGO cannot do that. But LISA will be able when they build it. You're aware of those experiments? LIGO, yes. LISA, you know? Solar system, Lagrangian point satellites, huge arms. And that will allow you to detect frequencies that are low enough to hear, perhaps, the gravitational wave background. That would be cool and super exciting. About 5 orders of magnitude more into the origin of the universe than light. Looking forward to it. Fingers crossed for those geometric factors to be nice to us. Huh? Anyway. All right. So what do we have here? Well, obviously, we have this, the Klein-Gordon equation, the wave equation with a mass in there, but I'm going to use we'll talk about it. The results I'm going to tell you are going to be for massless fields. But here's the thing. Of course, you know a little bit of that. I'm guessing, I don't know how much you've seen of this. This is kind of basic QFT in curved space, if you want. When you have, so if you realize, if you saw the FRW metric is conformally flat, in the coordinates I wrote it, it was explicitly conformally flat. But explicitly by that, I mean it's just look at it and say, oh, yeah, conformal factor times flat. Cool. Of course, you get a freedom in the action that is an ambiguity that you have to fix, which is you can add terms to the action that couple the scalar field to curvature, to the Ricci scalar. And you are free to choose that. You see, there's so many. So which one do we choose? That's a good question. You know what I mean? Who has arguments to choose one coupling or another, or 42, or 1 over 6, or 0? The most common ones are 1 over 6, 1 over 6 for 3 plus 1 dimensions. This is dimension dependent, obviously. In 1 plus 1 dimensions, actually, this is 0, which is nice. The two couplings coincide. So either 0 or 1 over 6. What do you think, people? You have ideas? I don't know how much you've seen or discussed these things, but those things are often, when you build up on more complicated stuff, as in like, I don't know, you do things on ADS, and you do things on other more complicated stuff, usually someone assumes something. But it's often not discussed why, or if there's any rationale to actually pick one or another, or we should be careful because maybe you don't have a good reason, and maybe it's up to the experiment to tell you, and we don't have experiments that tell you. You know what I mean? So do you have any, have you ever discussed that? Anyone? Or red? Okay. Well, then I'm going to give you my take, huh? But my take is my take. Okay? So sometimes we move from fact to opinion. I don't think that's a good reason to pick one or another. Now, I can tell what's behind either of them. The conformal coupling is such that, well, if the field is also massless, then the action is conformally invariant. And that is nice, because if you have conformal symmetry, things are nice and easy and so on. Also, boring with respect to the Strong-Huygens principle, because if you have conformal symmetry, So I can compute the Green function. Keep in mind, the Green function, if you want, is a solution of the wave equation. Right, how do a solution to the wave equation relate from the case of flat spacetime that we know and a conformally flat spacetime? Oh, that's easy. Conformal factor square, right? You just multiply by a conformal factor. All right, but multiplying by a conformal factor does not change the support. Agreed? So if you're in 3+1 dimensions flat, and then you are now in 3+1 dimensions conformally coupled, then you don't get violations of Strong-Huygens in 3+1, because the flat one doesn't have it. So kind of boring for this one. Now, again, the only reason I know is picked this conformal coupling is for symmetry reasons. There's something that people value. It's a human kind of thing, which is symmetry. And this imposes a lot of symmetry if the field is massless. I do not know any more reasons. There's no physics telling you conformal coupling makes sense, as far as I know. Oh, renormalization flows, kind of RG flows go really well and make sense. Fine. Yeah, but this is kind of our bias, I believe. This is our theories that we can treat, and that's a case that we can do it. If you think I'm wrong, please do discuss. Yeah? I would love to discuss this, because I could be wrong. This is an opinion. Eh? Minimal coupling. Minimal coupling kind of gives good predictions. So minimal coupling is what we often use to get power spectra in theory that kind of matches the cosmic background. It allows you to define the vacua that has the properties of the things that we observe in cosmic background. That said, you can make compatible conformal coupling as well. But this one is the one that's usually used. So at least this one has a little bit. Of course, there's also a reason, which is making things zero is the first thing you do without thinking, right? Like if you have to pick one value, why not zero? Maybe simplifies things. Turns out that this simplifies it more, but this is also very simplifying, if you want. So here we're going to work in minimal coupling. But keep in mind that Strong-Huygens is violated any time you violate conformal symmetry. So if the field has a mass, it will violate definitely Strong-Huygens. If the field had a mass or acquire a mass, some dynamics that give it mass, right, then it will violate Strong-Huygens. And if it's minimally coupled, definitely violates Strong-Huygens, except for particular cases. So that's the thing. You see, mathematicians found that in a radiation-dominated universe where the mass is the square root of the Hubble scale, you have Strong-Huygens, but that's a chance and not any other value. So it's it's interesting, right? That's a massive field in FRW that has Strong-Huygens. Kind of cool, huh? Anyway, we can talk about it later, what the mass means in curved spacetimes and so on. All right, so we're gonna consider different cases. So anyway, it's not so important. Sometimes we vary the time separation in a particular set of coordinates, sometimes the spatial. But let's talk a little bit more about what we're going to actually analyze here. The signal estimator, let's write it. We did already for flat spacetime. And for flat spacetime, we found, so look at the difference. The difference here is that you get the element of volume here is the element of volume for the curved spacetime that we are considering, in this case, FRW. And it's pretty much the same kind of thing that you got in flat spacetime. Okay? Now, of course, in this case, if you have conformal coupling, of course, what you get is, unsurprisingly, that's what I told you, right? The commutator, in the case of conformal coupling, we have full symmetry. In the case of, for whimsical reasons, we picked conformal coupling. then we get that the commutator, of course, is the ones that you found yesterday, remember? 1 over the distance, deltas on the light cone, right? Only multiplied by the conformal factor, obviously. You have conformal symmetry, the solution to the wave equation is just multiplied by the conformal factor, minus 1 in this case, twice. Okay, because it's the adiatic, the Green function. Agreed, people? Okay. So that's kind of boring. What happens in the case of minimal coupling? Oh, I didn't have it here. Okay, I'll get later. I'll get it later. So maybe I messed up the ordering. Yeah, for some reason I messed up the ordering. For conformal coupling, definitely you're going to get boring things. There's no time-like communication. When I talk, the one thing to say, when I talk about a channel capacity here, again, this is an information notion, the channel capacity requires you to either maximize overall protocols, and that's the true channel capacity, or restrict yourself to some protocols that you're going to use and optimize over that, and that is a restricted channel capacity. So in particular, we're going to use a communication protocol here. Alice emits information, Bob receives information. So the way this is going to work is Alice encodes a 1 by coupling decided if she couples the detector to the field or not. So a 1 is when Alice decides, I'm going to couple my detector for a finite time, that's sending a 1. It's like Morse code, right? You do coupling, then you send a 1. You do not do coupling, you send a 0. Okay? And then the readout, Bob switches the detector on and measures its energy, right? If B is excited, then Bob interprets a 1. If it's a 0, interprets a 0. That's the protocol. Of course, there can be false 1s and false 0s, right? The probability of detection can be through local noise a 1 for B when Alice did nothing. Or it could be a 0 because it missed the signal from Alice. I mean, the probability is small, if you want, if it's perturbative. Luckily, this thing is, with the probability we saw before, is known in information theory. This is what we call a noisy asymmetric binary channel. And the channel capacities are computed already, so that we can use all those results. I mean, computed in terms of what we have. Remember, this S2 is the second order correction to the signaling estimator we defined before. And remember, the signaling estimator is the part of the probability of excitation of B that depends on lambda A. OK? Getting everyone with me? I don't want to lose anyone here. Questions or anything? OK. Right, so for conformal coupling, this would have been before or after. That's in the middle. For conformal coupling, we found that two things, right? It decays with the spatial separation, and it's supported only on the light cone. Yeah. OK, what happens in the case of, well, of course, it's too similar to flat space then, right? What happens in the case of minimal coupling? Well, in the case of minimal coupling, you get, of course, the same result for S2. Again, remember, that's what we computed yesterday, OK? The part of the density matrix that is diagonal, the probability of excitation on Bob, the part that depends on signaling, that depends on lambda A, lambda B, OK? The commutator, in general, in the case of minimal coupling, is this one. And look, we have a G hat in here. What is that G hat? And that is it. So it's not there. It's super simple in the sense that you have closed form expressions for it, which is nice enough, trust me. But you see this alpha, remember, this alpha in here is coming from the equation of state. So depending if you have a matter-dominated universe or radiation-dominated universe, a cosmological constant-dominated universe, you have different values for that alpha. So in general, is this. There's a case in which it simplifies a lot. If this universe is matter-dominated, then alpha is equal to 2. And then the scale factor goes like eta squared. And that's proportional to t, 2 over 3. Didn't I tell you the difference between eta and t? Eta is conformal time. T is commoving time. So tx, if you want, is the reference frame in which you see the universe being homogeneous and isotropic in FRW. And eta is the time associated with a reference frame in which the metric is explicitly conformally flat, as in like really conformal factor times flat metric. OK? The one of people like us is t. We are people that kind of see the universe homogeneous and isotropic. We are kind of almost to a very good degree, we are commoving observers. Commoving means commoving with a Hubble flow. That's why we use commoving. Usually in relativity, we use commoving when we move at this, the same parallel geodesic than someone else. But here we're talking about the Hubble flow when we say commoving. All right, so in a matter-dominated universe, this thing is simple. Look at that. The Bessel functions become trigonometrics. And that is nice, because if they're trigonometrics, you plug them in there, and then you can do all the integrals analytically in closed form. How nice is that? Not true in general, just for matter-dominated. So for matter-dominated, I can get an expression for the commutator, and here it is. This is, I write commutator, but I mean the Pauli-Jordan. This is an abuse of notation. I mean the expectation of the commutator on the state of the field. So nice. Let's look at it. That's the case for conformal, so only supported on the light cone. And here you get a singular part that is supported on the light cone, but you also get a leakage inside the light cone, which, look at this, it does not decay with the spatial separation. There's a time-like leakage. It does not decay with spatial separation. And then you can see it here. This is two things, the channel capacity in bits per use of the channel, and the signal estimator, the correction to the probability of B getting excited that is proportional to lambda A. And then you can see, like, when you are in spatial separation, of course, space-like separation, you cannot signal. Capacity is zero, obviously. When you get into light contact, this is the beginning of light contact. This is the beginning of pure time, like, no, my bad. Starts to be partially in light contact, starts to be totally in light contact. When you're light contact, you're also time-like contact, some of the points, right, at the beginning. But you see how it peaks at full light contact, and then it goes down. But you see, in the conformal case, I call it S delta for the conformal case, is zero again. So you cannot communicate if you're time-like separate. That's the thing of if you miss the beam, you cannot sit there and get the message later on. But in the total one, which is the, like what I call total here, is the minimal coupling case, matter dominated in this case, you get something that does not decay with distance. It did have some conformal factors in there. So it decays with the distance to the Big Bang. You can tell it here. Yes, when you are in space contact, in space-like contact, there's no communication, and here you see a decay, right, going down. That decay can be compensated, actually. So if you wanted, so if you're in a matter-dominated universe, you could think of distributed a network of detectors. So if you distribute a network of detectors at some point and they get expanded and cover a volume or a surface, if you want, then the growth of those detectors in time, the volume they cover, right, can compensate for that decay if you want it. I mean, this is kind of an appreciation. We can talk about it, but doesn't necessarily need. So interesting enough, if you want to see it, because we don't have time, you can check this paper. If you are in the De Sitter case, also a cosmological constant dominated universe, positive cosmological constant, then there's no decay in time either. How is that? The signals, the time-like signals, will not decay in time. So what does that mean, though? Look at that. So if we are to see signals from the early universe, right now we do it only with light. But the information carried by light decays in time, polynomially, as you saw. Well, like an area law, not surprisingly. It's the energy kind of thing that gets distributed. Time-like signals decay slower or not at all, depending on the universe you're in. So maybe we should look at time-like signals to learn about the early universe rather than just light signals. Now, that's complicated. You need an antenna you can put in superpositions and so on. But there are ways we can maybe design antennas to see this. Also, you need to discriminate events. That's non-trivial. But just leaving it there. There's more information in time-like signals through massless fields that reach us nowadays than there is through light about the early universe. How is that? Are there any questions? I would have many questions if someone plays something like that. Wait, maybe later. Let's understand a little bit this scenario, right? I already told you a little bit, but so imagine that we start in an initial state of the two detectors in a pure state, and that pure state is this superposition, right? You do again, this is the what we call the signaling estimator that we had. This is the initial probability of excitation of Bob. The probability of getting Bob excited, if you want, through interactions with local vacuum, if you want, or the local state of the field. And this is the signaling term. Remember, the signaling term depends only on expectation of commutators, so it's state independent. I don't need to assume a particular state of the field to have that, a leading order. I don't need to assume a quantization scheme. That's why I talked about the Bunch-Davis vacuum, to be able to quantize the field. That's what I need. But let's analyze the different terms that contribute to this communication scenario. So of course, we have the initial noise, if you want, so the initial probability of finding it excited. And then those terms are local noise. Agreed? Then you have communication terms, like these two. So let's just show them. Right. You have the noise, and you have the signaling terms in here, right? Now, again, this thing is what means to exchange photons, in the sense of like, oh, I get detector A de-excited that emits a photon, that photon is captured by detector B and gets excited. This has a process of fourth order, like this one. These kind of interactions I call here customer-like. What do I call them customer-like? Well, we kind of know these things, right? It's like A makes a modification of the field that can be felt by B. Like if you have a cavity and you like plug in a mirror, say you plug in a mirror, and you wait for a while until the transients from plugging the mirror go away. Those are kind of interesting transients. Do you know about them? What happens when you slam a mirror in space-time and you have a quantum field in it? No? It's one of the canon scenarios in the literature for generating negative transitionary densities. We're talking about that. Anyway, you can slam a mirror and then you get things that happen in the field and they propagate away after some time, field thermalizes if you want with that. And then you can place an atom at some distance from the mirror. How long does it take for the atom to know that there's a mirror in there? How long? Who can know? Who can tell me the answer? Or an answer?
Instantly. Oh. Instantly?
Kind of. It's still dynamics, right? It needs to evolve a little bit. But yes, technically instantly. I mean, the detector only evolves coupled to the field with the coupling strength. So kind of times that are of the order of 1/1 the coupling strength, right? It will notice, but yes, instantly. If you are a beast and switch on the interaction fast, super fast, then instantly if you want. Instantly. And the reason is that the vacuum has information that is a mirror in there. When you're in a cavity, the vacuum of that state of the field in a cavity has information that there's a cavity, there are walls in there everywhere, right? The discrete levels of energy. So the atom can feel it instantaneously. Or the atom would feel a Casimir force instantaneously if you want. This is the kind of thing that is like that. You would feel, you can think classically of it as the following. Right. In 1 plus 1D, it's so easy to get intuition. Right. You are in the vacuum state of a field here. So the stationary density contains time derivatives and spatial derivatives. So if I'm originally in the vacuum, the expectation of a stationary density is, so think classically if you want, the stationary density is zero. But then I connect Alice here, and I change the state of the field. There's energy here, right? There's the amplitude of the field is changing. So the derivative with respect to time will be non-zero. So you have some stationary density that, of course, will propagate at the speed of light. Not inside, though, only at the speed of light. The stationary density does propagate at the speed of light. However, the amplitude here go from phi 0, say 0, to phi 1. Here, the amplitude of the field has changed. And it's changing in the whole time-like area. So the amplitude, of course, the stationary density here is still 0, because it's now constant. I moved the amplitude from 0 to 1. It's not changing anymore. It's constant. So stationary density is still 0 inside. However, the amplitude changed. Now, if someone else couples here now, that someone else is going to make the energy change again, the amplitude, but then the amount of energy is going to cause you to change the amplitude is dependent on the fact that you had phi 1 instead of having phi 0. I mean, you have a different state of the field. It costs you more energy to push it, right? So this is what's happening. Or a string, if you want, right? A string, you can displace a string like this, and then there's energy that goes like propagates in waves. When you move, I take a string that is covering the whole room, and I go like, whoa, I raise it a bit. And then the perturbation propagates and goes. And I have no gravity, yeah? This is in the absence of gravity or anything. I move it like that, and then a wave moves and propagates, and the whole string now is resting in a different position. Right? So energetically, they're equivalent. Having it here or here is the same. But someone that comes later can notice that the string was not in the original position, even though energy doesn't arrive them, right? So there's an afterglow, if you want. There's an echo of things. This is kind of hand-wavy ways of getting some intuition about violations of Strong-Huygens and why they're not zero and so on. Well, it doesn't really help you as much because in 3 plus 1D is zero exactly. But this is the kind of thing that's going on. All right, the Casimir-like interaction for the case of a two-level system are only present if you have superpositions. So in that sense, we claim that we need quantum antennas for it. Not so true if you have more dimensions in the antennas. Huh? But we can discuss that later. All right, so that was about a Big Bang kind of scenario, so standard cosmological model. What happens if you have a quantum bounce? So the quantum bounce setting, this is inspired by a result in loop quantum cosmology, doesn't need to. So the only assumption that is made here, well, it depends. If you have the full bounce, then you need to have a bouncy theory, whatever it is. If you don't, you can just say, right, sure, maybe close enough to the Planck scale, whatever that is. So funny, when people make statements like at the Planck scale, as people who know relativity, aren't you like bothered? Planck scale, as measured by whom? Because that's an observer-dependent statement. When you talk about energy scales, they depend on the observer, right? So what is meant when people say Planck scale then? There's some privileged observers that have the Planck scale at which quantum gravity shows up. It doesn't mean that for all observers it will manifest, so I just need to boost myself, which is, by the way, something that lives invariant. It's violations of Lorentz. So what they actually mean is it's more like local Lorentz invariance is violated, perhaps, and you will be able, perhaps, to feel it, everyone, at that scale? I don't know. So it's a vague statement. So kind of ask about it when people say Planck scale. Huh? What do you mean by Planck scale? As seen by whom? OK? Anyway, so let's say that we believe that at some energy level of some kind, right, we have GR working. That we know. That then as you go back in time, if you want, in cosmology, you get energy densities that are higher and higher and higher, right? And then at some point you say, well, maybe GR fails at some point. And when GR fails, we don't even know if we have geometry, perhaps not. In fact, we may have geometry, or we may not have geometry, depending on what do you like better. Do you like string theory? Do you like loop quantum gravity? Do you like causal sets? Depending on what you like more, you can talk about, oh, there's still geometry of some kind. There's no geometry, right? The most conservative option is to say geometry may not exist. We may not have a geometric theory anymore of any kind. But even so, there should be an intermediate regime, though, right, where you have, the same way you have post-Newtonian mechanics, as in, like, you can add a little bit of GR correction by modifying the potential, the Newtonian potential, but the next order term that you get from GR in a particular frame. Perhaps you can do the same with GR and have post-Einsteinian correction, which is a GR theory in which the dynamic equations are corrected by corrections that come from quantum gravity. So in that realm, these results I'm going to tell you work, no matter the theory. As long as you don't go through the bounds, right, anyway? Or depending on when the bounds happens. Oh, imagine that the quantum, I rectify. If the bounds happens in the post-Einsteinian, imagine that you have a universe that is contracting, right? And then it's contracting, the energy density gets to close enough to the Planck scale, whatever that is, get a post-Einsteinian correction coming from quantum gravity to GR. Still GR works, but not quite Einstein equations works. It's Einstein equations plus corrections coming from quantum gravity, right? And then imagine that those corrections induce a bounce, so you don't have a singularity and you don't get any more, any closer to the Planck scale. You bounce back and the energy density goes down. Then you didn't really, though you didn't dive inside the quantum gravity regime, you grazed it, and the corrections took you away from it. That's a pretty realistic, that's a pretty possible or feasible scenario. Perhaps you cannot really get, perhaps cosmology dynamics is such that doesn't let you get into the quantum, full quantum regime, only graze it a little bit, and then provoke things that deviate from the standard cosmology. That's a prediction from loop quantum cosmology. The prediction is that they do have predictions in which the post-Einsteinian, this is a name that I use, it's not common though, but you know what I mean by that, right? The same way I use post-Newtonian, I use post-Einsteinian here. The post-Einsteinian corrections to Einstein equations make the space-time bounds, so cosmology never gets into a singular regime, into a quantum, fully quantum regime. They do predict that. So in those scenarios is what I'm going to talk about. It's kind of fictitious, but it's kind of nice because the reason I want to talk about it is to have some fun at the end of the lecture. How much information survives? Oh, you can use this to distinguish if the theory, if there's a quantum bounce or not, by the way, because in the early universe it's different. There's some time in which they are different, small time, but maybe the signal from those times can carry to nowadays and so on. That's science. Instead of science, let's do a little bit of fun sci-fi with this. So I'll give you an idea of what this protocol is, because the particular result is not as much important as to understanding what's behind it. How much information survives a cosmological cataclysm? What do I mean by a cosmological cataclysm? Something like a quantum bounce. Okay? So instead of, they call it a quantum geometry, and they write this. I don't even know. This is not, I didn't do this plot. I took it. Which is sad, because I don't even reference where I took it. But sorry about that, internet. Yeah, maybe it doesn't get to quantum. It just graces the quantum regime and then bounces back. So it contracts and then bounces back. So this is where we are right now. If that were the case, that's a pretty bad cataclysm. So imagine, here's the thing. So complex systems definitely will not survive a bounce. So if the universe is contracting, the energy density will be high enough to destroy any bounce system, right? So imagine that you are, so how, who knows how long humans have been on Earth? Ballpark.
Humans?
Yeah. Homo sapiens sapiens.
2 million years?
Homo sapiens sapiens, not as much. But yes, around. If you want, well, let's be conservative. 2 million years, yeah. People using tools, yeah. I guess what we would call people, yes, about 2 million. Yeah, that's a good one. It depends when you, what level of sentience make a living being people. That's a different discussion. But let's say, to be conservative, 2 million years. I mean, I would say that anyway, 2 million years is fine. How long have we actually had any clue about how the universe works? A little bit. How long? Come on, you know that? Yeah, say it.
2000.
Maybe, yeah, yeah. And for real?
For real, 200.
Yeah, and even, I would say, even 100, depending on who you are. So, of the orders of hundreds of years only. Okay, so we've been around for so little though. Huh? Imagine that in a pre-bounce universe, you have a civilization that has been around, a sentient civilization with our intellect or better, that has been around for trillions and trillions of years with knowledge of physics. So they have enough time to figure out all physics that they can. Everything that's knowledgeable about physics by a sentient brain like ours, or directly or indirectly, through our comprehension or through like improving ourselves with artificial intelligence to actually comprehend more, then they got there. They got all the physics that is to know. Okay, imagine that kind of super powerful, that's kind of godlike powers to us. Literally, it's godlike powers to us. They know physics and they know how to use it. And with our best, you know, I mean, there's people that look into these things and talk about what a civilization is. So difficult to predict what a civilization is like with a technology level much higher than ours. There's a classification, I don't know if you know it, that is based on how much energy can they use efficiently. So it's level one, is they use the home planet energy efficiently, order of magnitude wise. Level two, they use the solar system, the local solar system kind of like efficiently energy, that's level two. It's a logarithmic kind of scale, which is nice. In logarithmic scale, the difference in energy scales is the same as when you go from solar system to local galaxy and so on. And that classification puts humans at 0.6. People kind of have ideas of what would it be like a civilization of level two. Oh, yeah, they build Dyson spheres around the sun. And what do they look like? Well, our better predictions predict something like this. But we're not sure. This is kind of all that we can do with our knowledge right now. So imagine an ancient pre-bound civilization that is extremely advanced, that they look more or less like that. And they know everything there's to know about physics. And they live in a pre-bounce era, and because they know everything that there is to know about physics, they know they're going to die. They know that they're doomed. You know, they find, well, we all know we're going to die. We have all sorts of horrible endings for the universe, right? In fact, a bouncy universe is much better than an expanding universe, in my opinion. But anyway, so they know they're going to die because of the bounce, right? And they don't want to die. So they think a lot about, okay, what can we do not to die? If there's a cataclysm like that, what would you do if you wanted your legacy to survive? Yeah, you know that you cannot store. Hopefully, what you could do is, all right, I'm going to scan myself, store all that information, and then reconstruct it in the future, right? That would be cool after the bounce. But it's difficult to store anything if atoms, nuclei, hadrons will not survive a quantum bounce. The energy scales we're talking about destroys any bounce system we know of. So what can you do then? Well, what you can do, though, you know that quantum fields will be there. Yeah, and they know all the interactive theory that they have. They know everything. So they know what fields are the real fields in there, so quantum fields will still be there. Maybe what they would do, though, is laugh at, oh, you're still using quantum field theory? They would, maybe. Anyway, the point being is, like, they know what the equivalent to that is. They know quantum fields. So let's assume that quantum field theory is right. So they have atoms, and they have knowledge about quantum fields. So they can actually use those atoms to encode information in the quantum fields. And what they may think is that, all right, fair, I interact with a bunch of atoms encoding all information about me and my civilization. And maybe in the hopes that in the future, there will be a civilization as advanced as us that can read out that information and perhaps reconstruct us. So assuming optimality, assuming that both civilization on both ends can do things as optimal as possible, how much information is recoverable after a quantum bounce? Is there a channel capacity? Maybe there's no hope. Maybe there's too much noise. Maybe there's no channel capacity. So that's the question we're gonna talk about now. Any questions about this scenario? All right. So you have a detector before a bounce and a detector after the bounce, far from the quantum regime, if you want, where atoms can exist, okay, when detectors can exist. And we compute the channel capacity between the two. Now, this is relying on something that is not, there are several assumptions here. The assumption number one is that the theories that we know are quantum, as in, like, well, to explain the fundamental interactions, we have quantum theories. So this is kind of what people call the church of the larger unitary, larger Hilbert space, right? Believing that everything is quantum, meaning that quantum theory, if you believe in quantum theory, information cannot be destroyed. You know that, right? Information can be scrambled like that. You can do that, for sure. That's allowed by quantum theory. But if you can dilate your Hilbert space always, the evolution is going to be globally unitary. So all that you're doing is reshuffling the information from one place to another. You cannot increase the entropy. So you can just scramble it. Oh, you cannot increase the entropy globally. You can increase it locally. This is what we are doing here. All right? The room that contains this thing still has all the information, only that it's very difficult to put together again locally. So maybe what happened is that what the cataclysm does is something like this, and maybe it's possible that in the future we can read it out, the code, and recover the information that was encoded before the bounce. And let me just show you a couple of, same thing. I'm going to show you a couple of results. Indeed, I mean, this is kind of like perhaps what you would expect. Even in cases of post-Newtonian corrections to Friedman equations, in this case, to Einstein equations, if you want, that translate into post-quantum corrections to Friedman equations at the Planck scale or whatever you want to fix that scale to, for comoving observers. So the way we implement Planck scale here is saying Planck scale for comoving observers. Okay. Then Strong-Huygens is violated for minimal coupled fields, and you get information propagating from the past to the future, from the pre-bounce era to the future. So here's a conclusion. Information can be, information propagates from early universe to our era. So the conclusion in general is, yes, a civilization would be able to do that if quantum theory is correct, and quantum field theory as we understand it is correct. And quantum gravity is only graced in cosmology, as in, like, we have corrections coming from quantum gravity, but geometry still stands, which could be a plausible scenario. It's predicted by some models, even. So this is a different paper that is not about Strong-Huygens, but I have it here because it's kind of about, yes, information from fluctuations from the early universe can be recovered nowadays, even though they're far away. And this is kind of an application. Right, I mean, I'm not going to get into this too much, but just to think about it, right? To test proposals of quantum gravity, we need two things, right? Predictions and experimental data. This is what makes it tough. It's tough to get predictions, it's tough to get experimental data. And of course, the best test bed that we know of is cosmology. If you are one of the very hopeful people in quantum gravity, 20 years ago, you would have expected the LHC to reveal some of that. Do you know how many people actually believed, and I'm thinking believe here, that there would be minimally coupled supersymmetry in the standard model, like corrections to the standard model, that people will find supersymmetric partners in the LHC? 99% of high energy physicists, well, I don't know 99%, but a lot of high energy physicists. And that's kind of revealing a human bias, right? When we invest a lot of our time researching on a topic, we become hopeful that that topic is right. People work under the assumption supersymmetry existed, at least minimal supersymmetry, okay, existed. And it looks like it doesn't. So if you want to do string theory and you want to have fermions and bosons and all the things that we actually see, you need to get complicated as hell. Because you don't have minimal, doesn't look like we have minimal supersymmetry in the standard model, in the post-standard model. So yeah, predictions are tough. Experimental data, right. The moment we don't have the minimal one, it could be any scale, we don't have particle colliders that can get to arbitrary scales, right? It's kind of pointless, I think, to build more particle colliders. It's not right now. But what I mean is, like, we already have a test bed that has way more energy than any particle colliders we can build in the foreseeable future, which is cosmology. If you can identify early universe signatures, then you can do high energy physics again. I'm telling you, if we have LISA, we can dig more than five orders of magnitude to any of the results and predictions that we have nowadays. So all that I'm saying is that looking at cosmological effects from the point of view of relativistic quantum information makes sense. And this is something that not only me, but other people have done. Makes sense because it's telling you, OK, let's be serious. How much information, really, can we get from early universe to nowadays? And what are the optimal ways of obtaining that information? Perhaps it's not what we are using right now. Perhaps it's not just naively write a power spectrum function, which, as you know, is kind of like, oh, yeah, Fourier transform of the Wyman function, you mean, right? It's not enough to write that and compare it with the cosmic background. Maybe we want to do more things. So I hope that this inspires you a little bit, or at least gives you an idea that it's interesting. There are many problems. Huh? I kind of told you like the bright side of it. Of course, there are complications, problem. Oh, you're talking about signal, but what about noise? And that channel capacity assumes a small coupling. What happens if the coupling strength was actually really high in the early universe? You know what I mean? Like, there are assumptions here that we can discuss, but at least it's revealing that even for the most naive scenarios that we consider nowadays, information can propagate not only by light, can propagate through time-like signals much more efficiently than it can propagate by light. And I think I'm going to stop here. I'm not going to talk more about communication because I want to do tomorrow quantum energy teleportation, that is cool. So that in the tutorial, here's how things are going to work. And correct me if I'm wrong, Agi, you're the boss. So tomorrow, we're going to see a quantum energy teleportation. How many of you know about that at all? You do? Cool. That's nice. I want to publicize it. It's a great idea. Masahiro Hota's idea. Quantum energy teleportation, we're going to do a theory, a toy model, to show what this quantum energy teleportation thing is. We're going to discuss how it applies to quantum fields. And that discussion, we're going to have half of it in the lecture, half of it in the tutorial. That works?
Yeah, so we're definitely going to have the discussion on Friday.
Yeah, that's why. No. What I'm talking is the talk, part of the lecture of how it works in quantum fields, part of it is going to be tomorrow lecture, part of it in the tutorial. Yeah. And on Friday, what I had planned is to have a discussion section, maybe not being recorded, if that's what Agi suggested, so you guys can talk without fear. I really want to discuss things. I kind of presented you a lot of things. And some of them are not, they're not super mainstream in many of the fields that you're already working on, I guess. They are really, the nice thing is that they are so related to all the mainstream things, touch them, all of them, but it's not kind of, it's probably different from the things that you've seen. I would love to hear your input, to have discussion. That's what makes these things most useful. So we can talk a little. I can talk a little bit, and then you can hopefully we can discuss a little bit on all these results and so on. And on RQI, what RQI is and what it means and all this stuff, how it connects with things that you are doing, things that you're interested in, things like quantum information. How does that connect with quantum information mainstream? How does that connect with quantum optics mainstream? How does that connect with ADS-CFT mainstream? How does that connect with quantum gravity mainstream? How does that connect with quantum fields in curved space? So all those things, you know, all the things that you probably do I don't know what you guys do, but I assume it because PI, right? Ah, how does that connect with many body physics? It does too. With quantum thermodynamics tomorrow, a little bit of thermodynamics. Right. It does connect with quantum thermodynamics. So that's the roadmap. All right, so tell people, I want them to come tomorrow if they can at 9 a.m. All those people that are taking the course.
Tomorrow or on Friday?
Sorry, on Friday.
I sent an email asking everyone to come on Friday.
On Friday, yeah, definitely. But they also should have watched Thursday's lecture.
Yes.
Hopefully they will. All right, so just tell people if you can, all the PSI people. I want, you know, it's much more fun for everyone because if more of you are here, we have better discussions, we learn more things, you keep me honest. If I BS you, you can detect it, and then you can tell me about it, and I love when that happens. So don't feel that you're gonna offend me or anything. I love when people correct me. Well, as long as they don't insult me or anything, like explicitly, it's cool. Okay, then I'll see you tomorrow.